Thanks very much, Lars. So maybe we should set up here. So let's start. So the first speaker is Chaim Weidenkamp. I'm not sure if I pronounced your name correctly. Apologies for my German.
Very good.
Non-existent German. And the talk title is talk title, I guess, right? So we'll figure it out in a second. What's your talk title?
I don't remember. I'd say it in
English. That was for test for you, Victor. All right. There's your talk.
Oh. Jeremy, our protection in...
Cancel arsenic.
Yeah, and their variability in... Can you pronounce this thing for me?
Cobalt in sulfur?
Okay,
yeah,
very good.
Of course.
So we have 30 minutes.
Right. Thank you, Victor, and thank you for the organizer. I'm thrilled to open this week of talks in this KITP workshop that I guess has been going on for some time before and will continue after. And today I would like to discuss two of our works. One is a slightly older one, the work on tantalum arsenide. The second is more recent on the time reversal symmetry broken wild semi-metal cobalt in sulfur. And I think the comparison of the two is interesting and maybe goes a bit beyond the discussion of each one of them individually. So I will start with, basically, I would like to show you the properties that we found are characteristic to Fermi arcs in two of these wild semi-metals. And I'll start with what we've seen on tantalum arsenide, an inversion symmetry broken wild semi-metal, where basically I'll show how we see the presence of Fermi arcs in this material and how did we find a fairly robust behavior of these Fermi arcs in tantalum arsenide, and then contrast it with what we found in the second material. So I kind of skipped the introduction because I think the audience is quite familiar with the notion of wild semi-metals, but basically we have this bulk structure of pairs of wild Dirac bands, which then, when we project to the surface, give rise to this distinct surface state of the open contour Fermi arcs that have very interesting correspondence between the bulk and the surface, which is characteristic to a wild semi-metal. This is the simple picture that theory can suggest, and reality was a bit more complicated. In tantalum arsenide, we don't have two or four wild semi-metals in the bulk. We actually have 24 wild nodes that project to the 0, 0, 1 surface that we measure onto 16 wild nodes that accordingly have 8 Fermi arcs that should connect them on this surface. Even this is not the end of the story, because on top of that, we also have trivial states on the surface of tantalum arsenide, which are mainly derived from the dangling bonds on that surface. So our task and also opportunity was to distinguish the presence of Fermi arc bands on this complicated surface of tantalum arsenide, but by doing so, we try to also to learn in what way they are distinct from trivial bands. So one thing to look for, and that I'll try to address, is that the dangling bonds, the surface of tantalum arsenide, is arsenic terminated, which means that all the trivial bands that you see here are derived from the local potential imposed by the arsenic dangling bonds. However, the wild bands are mainly derived from the tantalum orbitals in the bulk. So the Fermi arc kind of have to decide what to follow, what they are, will be dominated by the surface arsenic potential, or by the topological tantalum-derived band structure, which is one thing we try to address in our research. So we do scanning tunneling microscopy and spectroscopy in my lab. This is a topographic image of the 001 surface of tantalum arsenide. You can see the atoms by comparing the local density of states given here in the solid line to DFT calculated band structure. We can see that indeed this looks more like the arsenic terminated surface than the tantalum terminated one, which means that all these dark spots are arsenic vacancies. And what we like to do in STM is let electrons scatter off whatever impurities we have on the surface and give rise to standing wave patterns that encode the wavelength of these electrons in some indirect way, which I'll address in a moment. So this is what we find, the local density of states. This is what happened to be taken at the Fermi energy, and you see this elongated complex structure that, again, encode, in some sense, the band structure of the material, of the surface states, And in order to resolve it, what we do is Fourier transform our measurements and find a very rich and beautiful pattern in momentum transfer space. And in order to understand what this all means physically, what we do is compare our measurement to joint density of state calculation that basically takes into account all the possible scattering processes within the surface band structure of the material. So I won't go through all of the processes. We could identify all of them, but we'll discuss mainly this ellipse-like structure that comes from scattering within the ellipse surface band. And of course, we're looking for some signatures of Fermi arcs on the surface. So if I zoom into the center of this Q-space zone, you will see again the signature of this ellipse band, but beyond it, you'll see this leaf-like structure that peaks out and can only be attributed for this scattering process drawn here that involves scattering to and from Fermi arc surface state. So this is one way we saw the presence of Fermi arcs in this material, and through bulk boundary correspondence, whenever we find an evidence for the existence of a Fermi arc open contour band on the surface, we know that this material must be a wild semi-metal, in this case, an inversion symmetry broken one. So, tantalum arsenide indeed seems to be a wild semi-metal and has Fermi arcs on the surface. What can we tell about these Fermi arcs? So one thing that we realize is that actually this scattering pattern is a bit more complicated than what we usually find in materials, and we try to understand what is the origin for this complexity. And by this I refer to the fact that the scattering patterns are replicated and appear in a very strange distribution around this Q space. So for example, this what we call bow tie signature that comes from scattering of this bow tie band hardly appears around a Q small momentum transfer, but appears very strong around the Bragg peak, which are these high dots that just come from the atomic structure of the arsenic terminated surface. So we see the bow tie band here. We hardly see it here. On the other hand, the ellipse band we see very strongly in the center, and half of it appears strong also around the Bragg peak. And this looks quite unusual. However, what really convinced us that actually this physics does not involve any specifics of the scatterers of the arsenic vacancies, but actually the wave function of the electrons, is what we saw in regions away from any apparent impurity on the surface, which I show here. So this is the real space local density of states, and as you can see, it is modulated in space, although there is nothing that scatters the electrons. So this, and in the paper, if you'll read it, you can see that there's actually correlation between how these patterns disperse in energy and how the quasi-particle interference pattern disperse in energy. So it indeed seems like they both come from the same physical origin, which is somehow imprinted in the wave function of the Fermi arcs and the trivial surface states. So what is this joint mechanism? What governs this replicated quasi-particle interference and modulated wave function on the surface? What we found is that this is all encoded in the Bloch structure of the wave function of the bands. So here I show you a calculation of the Bloch structure of the ellipse band. Usually we look in the first Brillouin zone when we consider the different scattering wave vector. However, whenever we think about electrons in a periodic crystal, we should consider the full Bloch structure of the wave function. And for the ellipse band, the trivial ellipse band, we see that we have dominant Bloch coefficients at several Brillouin zones. Now, this means that we'll indeed find scattering processes between different Brillouin zones when we look at the quasi-particle interference image, and we can really collect these scattering processes by their intensities one by one, and this is all governed by the Bloch coefficient intensities of the wave function of the trivial ellipse band. So this is the origin for all these different contributions that we find in the center around Bragg peaks, half strong, half weak. It is all dominated by the intensity of the Bloch coefficients of the wave function. Now, when we go to the Fermi arc and calculate its Bloch structure, we find a very different result. We find that it really has only a single Bloch dominant Bloch coefficient. which means that we'll only find it around the center zone, and we verified it in different ways in this work. But this, I mean, physically, what this means, having a Bloch state that has only one Bloch dominant Bloch coefficient, means that basically it's a plane wave-like. So the Fermi arc bands, in tantalum arsenide at least, hardly feel the underlying lattice potential imposed by these very strong arsenic dangling bonds, for example. So this seems to be an interesting property of the Fermi arc bands in tantalum arsenide, and we had one more interesting characteristic to show, which I alluded to in the previous slide, which is what will these Fermi arcs choose to follow, the tantalum origin, topological origin, or the arsenic surface potential. And for this, we looked also on scattering from these crystallographic steppages, which give rise again to a very complicated standing wave pattern that I show here in the local density of states versus energy and position away from the steppage. When we Fourier transform this image, we find this dispersing mode, which is how this ellipse structure disperses in energy. Again, it comes from scattering within this trivial ellipse band. However, when we zoom into this pattern, we see that actually it is fully commensurate also with the underlying topographic profile that we measure together with the local density of states. Whenever we're on arsenic sites, this raised topography sites, we have a higher density of states, and on tantalum sites, we have slightly lower density of states, and this doesn't seem to disperse much in energy. So this suggested that we can do a slightly more careful analysis and look at their contribution one by one. So we look only on the arsenic sites, we filter out the tantalum sites and Fourier transform them, and find again this the dispersion of this ellipse band, and this is indeed encoded on the arsenic sites. This band is derived from arsenic dangling bonds, so it all makes sense. Now we shift our filter half a unit cell aside to expose the tantalum sites and Fourier transform them, and find a completely different dispersion pattern that now, when we look what is its origin, we can only find one possible contribution, which is scattering within a single Fermi arc state on the surface. So by this, we can really see and show that the Fermi arc bands are not localized on the arsenic termination as all the different trivial bands of the surface are, but actually are localized on the tantalum sites, which again are also the orbitals that mainly contribute to the whale cones in the bulk of this material. So it seems that the Fermi arcs in tantalum arsenide don't care much about the surface potential. They really follow the bulk topological nature of this material, and they also don't see much the surface potential in the sense that they don't have a complex Bloch wave function structure. So this is more or less the picture that we got from tantalum arsenide, and we speculated maybe this is a really topological property of Fermi arcs in general. However, what we found in the second material that I'll talk about in cobalt tin sulfur is a very different picture, which was also interesting, but different, and I'll try to reconcile them at the end of the talk. So now I switch to talk about our observation in the time reversal symmetry broken whale semi-metal, cobalt tin sulfur. Again, I'll show you how we identify Fermi arcs in this material. Actually, the task was actually easier in this material. We also could see signature of time reversal symmetry breaking in our quasi-particle interference images. And at the end, we saw a very interesting response to this Fermi arc to the underlying surface potential in the form of rewired Fermi arcs on the surface. And I'll explain what this means. I'll try to. So cobalt tin sulfur has this crystal structure. It has triangular layers of tin and sulfur, and in between it has Kagome-structured cobalt ions, which are magnetic. They become ferromagnetic below 175 Kelvin, and it was predicted in calculation that within the ferromagnetic phase, this material would indeed turn into a magnetic wild semi-metal, having six wild nodes in the bulk that project to six wild nodes on the 001 surface of the material that we measured. There have been supporting evidence that this material might be indeed a wild semi-metal, both a very strong anomalous Hall effect and a negative magnetoresistance that is potentially coming from a chiral anomaly. And there was a very interesting paper, STM paper, on this material that focused on possible flat bands that form due to the Kagome structure of the magnetic ions. Very excitingly, a few weeks ago, three papers appeared from us and from two other groups that report existence of magnetic wild semi-metals. So I think this is what's exciting, is that I think we've been waiting for quite some time to really some spectroscopic verification for the existence of these magnetic topological materials. And what I find interesting in this material is that now that the topological classification is coupled to the magnetic order, we can tune the topology by tuning temperature or magnetic field and see how all these spectroscopic interesting features come out from trivial surface bend structure. This we could not do with these materials. The Curie temperature is too high in them for us to probe, but at least in the future, I hope we can do it in magnetic materials. So what did we see in cobalt in sulfur? Again, this is the topographic image of the surface, differential conductance maps that encodes this quasi-particle interference patterns. We Fourier transform them and get this very geometrical and sharp quasi-particle interference patterns at different energies. And they are so simple and geometric that we can almost reverse engineer the bend structure of the surface of this material. What we understand we should have is some kind of two nested hexagon-like patterns, and the scattering between them will give rise to these hexagonal features. We go down in energy. This hexagon should increase or decrease in size, which then gives rise to this larger hexagon, and also to these collinear side bands that give rise to these additional connecting lines that we didn't have at higher or lower energies. So we can indeed identify these motifs in the calculated bend structure, and this allows us to identify the positions of the wild nodes, projected wild nodes on the surface of the material, and to identify which of these bends are actually Fermi arc bends. So the bends that I've drawn here in pink are the Fermi arc bends in this material. And as you can see, all the scattering features that we measured basically involve these Fermi arc bands. And this is not a coincidence, not a coincidence that it was relatively easy to identify this Fermi arc contribution. This is because the Fermi arcs are very extended, are very long in this material. They occupy almost 50% in extent of the Brillouin zone. So this is believed to be an advantage, a spectroscopic advantage of wild semi-metals, to have well-separated wild nodes that give rise to extended Fermi arcs. It might come with some prices, I'll say at the end. But for now, we indeed verify the existence of Fermi arc on the surface. Can we also say something about time reversal symmetry breaking? So if you look on the bend structure, you can immediately say that indeed this seems to be a time reversal symmetry broken material, because the pocket around K and its time reverse partner at K prime are not the same. And now this means that in principle, we should get different scattering processes contribution from the K valley and the K prime valley, which is indeed what we could find in the QPI structure. So if I now show you the momentum cuts along these two directions, gamma K and gamma M, versus energy. And so far, we've been looking mainly on this strong mode. But if we look closely, you can maybe see that there's a second mode dispersing parallel to it. If I suppress the long wavelength contribution from the center, you can see it even clearer. There's a second mode that disperses parallel to the one we've been looking at before. And this indeed comes from the other scattering around the K prime point. So seeing this double mode dispersion is a signature of time reversal symmetry breaking in this material. So indeed, cobaltine sulfur in our measurement seems to be time reversal symmetry broken wild semi-meta. So far we've been looking on this termination of the material. What was nice in this material was that we could actually measure all three material element termination of this material. Two of them has triangular coordination, the third has this hexagonal-like pattern that we naturally attribute with the cobalt termination. And through these steppages between different terminations and spectroscopic features, we could identify the other two as being the sulfur and the tin termination of cobalt in sulfur. Now, each one of them come with its own reproducible point spectrum, which already means that these three terminations have a different surface band structure, but our way of characterizing this band structure is by measuring quasi-particle interference, and we could indeed do it on all three different terminations of the material. So what could we say about the Fermi arcs on these three different material terminations? This is the Fermi arcs that we've been looking at so far. This is how they connect the different wild nodes within the Brillouin zone. Now, we can always add trivial bands to the surface. These trivial bands may be degenerate, cross the Fermi arc bands, hybridize with them, and by this change their contour, change their dispersion. This is more or less what happens on the sulfur termination in a bit of a disappointing way, because what happened on the sulfur termination is that at all energies, these Fermi arcs overlap with other metallic surface states on the surface, so we cannot really say how the Fermi arc goes from one whale node to the other, what's the connectivity of the Fermi arcs between these different whale nodes. However, we can also consider trivial bands that look like this and can also hybridize with the Fermi arcs, and by doing so, change the connectivity, not only the dispersion, but the way the Fermi arcs connect the different wild nodes. And this is exactly what we saw on the cobalt termination in calculation in comparison to quasi-particle interference. We saw that on the cobalt termination, the Fermi arcs connects wild nodes through the edges of the Brillouin zone in an inter-Brillouin zone manner. And this dotted line is the edge of the Brillouin zone. And you can see how the Fermi arcs, these blue lines, connect the different wild nodes across the edge of the Brillouin zone. So what we find in cobalt tin sulfur is not only that the Fermi arcs are sensitive to the local potential, whether it's imposed by the cobalt atoms or the tin or the sulfur, this can even change their connectivity, not just their dispersion. So a very different picture than what we saw before in tantalum arsenide. So before I end with the comparison of the two and what could be the possible origin for it, let me just mention what could be the consequences of having these distinct connectivities governed by the surface termination. So, for example, looking on quantum oscillation, as you all know, when we apply a weak magnetic field, what happens in a wild semi-metal is that the surface electrons plunge into the bulk, follow a chiral mode, the quantized chiral mode of the bulk Dirac-Cohn, until they reappear on the opposite surface where they travel along the bottom Fermi arc, through the bulk and complete their quantum oscillation cycle, which involves surface and bulk motion. Now, if we consider a sample, as we had in our experiment, that has different terminations on opposite surfaces, this means that whenever the electron goes to the other surface, it will travel along a different Fermi arc that connect different wild nodes, and therefore it should go through all Fermi arcs on either surface and six times in the case of cobalt tin sulfur through the bulk before it goes back to its initial state. So we predict that we should find different quantum oscillation frequencies in such material. Maybe it will be even too rich to decode. Another interesting aspect is what happens along grain boundaries or steppages between different terminations. So somehow the connectivity has to switch from one to another. And one way to think about it is that maybe when you project these Fermi arcs onto this grain boundary, they would give rise to a different 1D mode that actually combines the two Fermi arcs into a closed contour this time. Surface states, a one-dimensional closed contour surface state, which is projected to this 1D band. So finding a distinct edge mode, a 1D mode, on the boundary of a three-dimensionally topologically classified bulk, whale semi-metal is what we usually call a higher order classification. So maybe this is one way of getting a higher order topological semi-metal by looking at these grain boundaries. And let me also add that very recently there's a second STM paper on cobalt in sulfur from Vidya Madhavan's group, where they claim to show some kind of edge mode that indeed lives on steppages of this material and seems to have a linear dispersion. So it's not really related to this concept, because in their case it was steppages between same termination, but not exactly. I can say more if you want during the discussion time. So having different connectivities on different surfaces should have also an imprint in magnetotransport and other measurements. And now let me conclude by trying to compare the different behavior of Fermi arcs that we found in the two materials. So again, in cobalt in sulfur, we saw that we can vary the dispersion, we can change the connectivity simply by changing the surface termination. Of course, both this material had the same, both these terminations had the same bulk band structure. We only changed the surface potential by looking at different material terminations. While in tantalum arsenide, we saw that the Fermi arcs are very protected, they don't see the surface potential, they don't care about it. So what could be the difference between the two? What we think is actually could be what made the Fermi arcs in cobalt in sulfur so susceptible to the surface potential is their strong property of having extended Fermi arcs between well-separated wild cones in the bulk. Because as you know, and as was demonstrated in STM also by the Yazdani group, the closer you go to the wild node, the further the Fermi arc state disperses, penetrates into the bulk. Now this means that when the whale nodes are very close to one another, the penetration depth will remain long throughout the extent of the Fermi arc. The Fermi arcs won't have enough momentum space to recover from this divergence into the bulk. However, in cobalt in sulfur, they can be much more localized on the surface, because in momentum they are very far, much further away from the momenta of the wild nodes. But this means that the Fermi arcs are more localized on the surface. Therefore, they will be more susceptible to perturbations imposed by the surface. So whatever surface band crosses these Fermi arcs, it would be much easier and much stronger hybridized to these Fermi arcs than to this one that has very small weight on the surface. So in that sense, having well-separated whale nodes is maybe good for seeing very clearly the spectroscopic features. It was definitely easier for us in cobalt in sulfur. However, it can come with a price that they will be more susceptible to the local surface potential. And then this means that you just need to choose what kind of property you want to utilize in these whale semi-metals. Do you want them to be more robust? Then maybe tantalum arsenide is a better choice. But if you want to have strong spectroscopic features, maybe you should go with material like cobalt in sulfur. So with this, let me just acknowledge the different people that contributed to this work. These are the students and staff from my lab. Lots of theory discussions with the DFT people and theorists, some of them here in the audience. And samples were provided by the Claudia Felser group. So maybe I'll just leave the summary on, and thank you.
We have a lot of time for questions.
Yeah, very nice data. So I have a question to the first part, to the tantalum arsenide. When you discussed the QPI there, you mm-hmm. mentioned that you also see intra-Fermi arc scattering.
Right.
So there I wonder to what extent the spin momentum locking plays a role in the intensity of the QPI that you see.
So if I go back to that QPI image, if you look on the DFT calculation, the joint density of states, then definitely it plays, let me go there. Right. I mean, the different shades of red that you see here, in part, come from the spin texture of these Fermi arcs. I don't think, and this has been the case in many of the works. In principle, it should be encoded. We didn't try to go that quantitative with the.
It's not UCI. Disentangled.
At least in this material, it was so hard to detect the signatures of the Fermi arc that we couldn't say something that quantitative. Actually, in the Yazdani work on Tantalum-Marshanak, this is exactly the kind of physics that they were looking into. But for us, at least in this work, the complexity of the surface band structure in this material allowed us to make more qualitative arguments than these kind of quantitative arguments.
Okay, thank you.
Unfortunately.
I guess I'm compelled to repeat the previous question because it didn't send the answer. So, once again, as far as I understand, QPI is based on the backscattering of some imperfections, right? So you basically measure the standing wave amplitude as a function of coordinate.
Mm-hmm.
So to start with, you have to have backscattering, right? Now, is there a spin locking and you scatter off a potential disorder, then there is some problem with backscattering, right? So I'll just repeat the question. So what are you scattering from, and what are the selection rules you assume when you interpret your data?
So my only objection is to the word backscattering, because QPI does not have to come from backscattering, it comes from scattering. It's true that whenever backscattering is allowed, usually it is dominated by the backscattering process, but maybe I can draw it. For example, in topological insulators having helical Dirac surface states, it's true that the backscattering process is prohibited, but we still see scattering, side scattering coming from these kind of processes. So even if direct backscattering is not allowed, you can have QPI patterns coming from other scattering processes in the material. There can be virtual processes also to going to other energies. So
Other energies are not allowed. I agree with that about the side scattering, but other energies, what do you mean? It's non-interacting physics, right? It's just standing wave.
Right, but all these processes energy. Contribute to the QPI pattern. Even in bismuth selenide, bismuth telluride, the canonical topological insulators, we could see QPI, and this is because we image scattering, not just backscattering.
Okay.
I mean, this will give rise to interference patterns. And the same, this calculation is not just the joint density of theta, as we call it, it's the SSP, the spin selective scattering probability. So this has the spin selection rules in it. Still, you see also in calculation that we get a finite signature.
Yeah, scattering of which obstacles is it?
So in the case of Fermi arcs, it's kind of half of this picture. So it's true that direct backscattering could be prohibited, but you can still get, and you do, get contribution from scattering of other states, which are not time reverse partners of each other.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. How accurately can you measure the distance between the two chiralities, the B vector?
So in tantalum arsenide or in cobalt in sulfur or in general? So it really depends on what kind of scattering process we were able to measure. So some of the scattering processes that I showed you also here before, not this one, which is intra Fermi arc process, but if we have scattering between Fermi arc and some trivial band, then we cannot say much about the separation of them. Actually, there was one more that I didn't show you, one more scattering process, for example, in tantalum-marshanide, that was an inter-Fermi arc scattering between the different Fermi arc states, and then we can say what is the momentum separation between them. So it's really dependent on what scattering processes we manage to visualize. In cobalting sulfur, this was even more direct observation because the Fermi arcs are much longer and the QPI patterns that degenerate is much more pronounced. I can also add that I think addressing this is maybe easier through ARPES, which really visualizes the surface band structure, but we can also say something about that.
So in the second part, you mentioned by the granular boundary, you can have high order topology. At least you have that discussion. I'm just curious about the what will you expect on that one-dimensional state?
Right. So in a time reversal symmetry broken material, I would expect to find a chiral edge mode. And this is kind of what you get if you, for example, this is one possible way to think about it. If you consider the Fermi arcs that we know we have by now in this material on either termination and think how they project, and these chiral Fermi arcs, how they would project onto a 1D mode, then you can find indeed that some will annihilate, but you will be left with chiral segments from these 2D Fermi arc states projected to the 1D boundary. I think this should be looked at theoretically and think really how to start from a 3D wild semi-metal and consider such grain boundaries, which I don't think has been done yet. But you know, seeing a step edge with different termination, you can also think of it as a partial edge dislocation in a sense. So you can think of this material also, if I have a step edge on the surface and I now, this is cobaltine sulfur, and I now cover it again with cobaltine sulfur, what basically I'm embedding is a edge dislocation, a partial edge dislocation in the material, which how this edge dislocation responds to the whale classification of the material is another way of trying to think what should be bound to this step edge.
Hi. Yeah, very, very, very amazing data. So do you have any sense of how inhomogeneous is the magnetization in your sample?
I have an idea just because I saw Claudia Felser showing a magnetic image of the surface of cobalt in sulfur, and there are ferromagnetic domains. But they are on a scale of microns. So we are kind of blind to them. If we happen to come across, the only thing we could see is maybe a 1D mode bound to there, but this would be by chance, and it didn't happen. But as you would expect, there are ferromagnetic domains in this material.
So actually, it's more a comment, a belated comment to Elonia's question.
Please.
I think it's, at least to me, it's easier to think about QPI as a mapping of the first order correction in perturbation theory to the local density of states as a consequence of the impurity. And when you just write it as a first order perturbation theory, you see that it's not just the standing wave, but meaning the k and minus k, but there's a contribution from all momenta. So even if the minus k, the scattering from k to minus k is ruled out by spin orthogonality, you have many other momenta.
But so, how can you see what are the characteristics of that? If it's
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably easier on a piece of paper. Let's talk about it on the paper.
I think this aspect was not fully studied yet, and we're trying also to look at this in interesting way. How can we tell if there's really side scattering and But it's true. It gives a more continuous contribution, unlike these hotspots that we like to see from backscattering.
Of cobalt in sulfur?
Yeah, it's in single layer. Is it magnetic? Is it Does it have
It wasn't, as far as I know, it wasn't studied, measured experimentally.
How many layers can they get down?
By exfoliation? We didn't really try to exfoliate this material. It's not a van der Waals, it's layered, but it's not van der Waals, so it's good for cleaving. I'm not sure it's good for exfoliation, but maybe thin film growth can do that. There is one theory paper by Mutzler and Yansun that studied a monolayer of cobaltin and found that, I don't remember if they assumed it's still ferromagnetic or calculated that the ferromagnetic order is still stable, but at least in their case, they found that it should be an anomalous Hall insulator. And this is what the paper from VDI started trying to study, not by looking at the monolayer, by looking on step edges, which is a monolayer on top of a bulk material. So slightly different, but addresses this issue.
Okay, any other questions? So actually, I have a couple of questions. So I have general questions about these magnetic well semi-metals. So I was wondering if somebody looked at the transition point where the transition into ferromagnetism occurs.
Right.
So is there anything funny going on there where it's just splitting?
So not in these materials, because the transition temperature, as I said, in cobalt in sulfur is 175 Kelvin, which is too high for us to do reliable QPI measurements. The tip just becomes too unstable at this temperature, thermally unstable, the last atom that we're trying to tunnel through. And the material from Zahid Hassan's group has an even higher transition temperature. So it would be interesting. I think, as far as I remember, cobalt in sulfur doesn't have the additional needed symmetries to be a Dirac semi-metal in the paramagnetic phase. When the two wild, the pairs of wild node merge together, if you want it to be a Dirac semi-metal, you need some additional symmetry to protect these Dirac cones. I think cobalt in sulfur doesn't have it, so it just turns into an insulator. We couldn't do it in this. I hope we'll have more magnetic topological materials where we can really look at these kind of transitions and how they come about.
Yeah, and also actually I have another general question. It's kind of naive question. So I understood, maybe misunderstood, that these Fermi arcs are projections essentially of the bulk bands, which is pretty global thing. And then you seem to be saying that by changing something very local on the surface, you're completely restructuring this projection. So
right.
What's the intuition of this, actually?
So this is kind of the misconception, in a sense, that what's really protected is the wild nodes and where they appear. This is something you cannot change by surface potential. It's really the bulk projection. Mm-hmm. However, how the Fermi arc disperses between the different wild nodes is not something that you can predict just by looking on the bulk band structure of the material. It's a consequence of the surface potential. You can vary it with doping the surface, with applying different perturbations, and one of them that we showed is by changing the surface termination. Mm-hmm. But there's no bulk boundary correspondence that predicts the connectivity of the Fermi arcs. So
you don't have to kind of involve scatterings between the wild nodes. You don't have to have commensurate wave vectors which kind of connect the wild nodes. Because if that were to happen, I would understand your concern.
Well, you cannot eliminate the Fermi arcs. They must connect the wild nodes of different chirality. And there are some, of course, this has to obey the surface symmetries of the material. It's not that every connectivity is valid, mm-hmm. but within these limitations of the surface symmetries, you have a set of connectivities which are allowed, and nothing chooses one of them other than the surface potential that you have.
All right, so I think thank you very much for the excellent talk and the great discussion.